I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The locks were supposed to be changed last night, new church keys to be held only by the Archdiocese of Boston. But the parishioners of St. Albert the Great's Catholic Church in Weymouth, Massachusetts, had other plans. They are now in a full-blown confrontation with the Archdiocese, occupying their church in a 24/7 prayer vigil. St. Albert's is one of the 82 parishes that Catholic leaders in Boston are trying to close. The Archdiocese claims it's part of a wide-ranging reorganization brought on by declining attendance and a lack of priests. But the parishioners of St. Albert's have another perspective. They claim they own the church, and they're taking their case to court and to an appeal of canon law. So today we're asking the same question they are. Who owns the church? Is it the Archdiocese, the church fathers, or is it the families that paid for the recent installation of 55 stained glass windows, along with the people who are married there and the people who go to Mass there and donate money? This question is being repeated in a number of other parishes and other parts of the country, so we'd like to hear from you who you think owns the church. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start our program this hour in Weymouth at St. Albert's Church, where that prayer vigil is underway. Colin Riley is joining us on the phone. He's a member of the parish council. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm well. What's the latest out there? What's happening?
Well, actually, it was just a very brief emotional moment when Father Ronald Coyne just left the parking lot after the vicar came by and essentially accepted the keys to the rectory, but not to the church. The members of the parish are still keeping vigil upstairs. I'm down in the church hall with several parishioners here.
This must be unbelievably emotional for the people who are there.
Extraordinarily.
Now, you didn't give the keys to the church, to the vicar, is that right?
Correct. And I just wanted to say something. You mentioned that we're sort of in a confrontation and with the Archdiocese. This is not something we desired. In fact, we desired communication and dialogue all the way through, and it was really a one-way street. We were trying to get some feedback and have a dialogue about what is the benefit to the Archdiocese of closing a vital, vibrant, thriving, engaged parish community. And
that's a pretty important part of this story, if I understand it, Colin, that some of the churches, some of the parishes that have been closed did, in fact, have declining attendance and the buildings were in need of some repair. But that's not the story of St. Albert's, as I understand it.
No, it's not the story of St. Albert's. In fact, we meet none of the criteria, the underlying factors. But Archbishop O'Malley says, well, that wasn't it meant to be for a local cluster. It was supposed to be meant for the entire archdiocese and viewed in the context of the entire archdiocese. The problem with it is that he said in his denial of our canon appeal that to the best of his ability, he used the existent clusters to go through and to ask the questions of the reconfiguration teams if the archbishop needs to close a parish for the benefit of the archdiocese, which parish should that be? And it was pretty straightforward with five parishes located in Weymouth, one, though, that serves parts of Braintree as well, and that's Sacred Heart and Weymouth Landing, that three of them have schools, so it came down to two parishes, and we, St. Albert the Great Parish, is the smallest, although probably, arguably, the most engaged with a number of community programs for people of all ages, Color Guard, adult softball teams, trips to Six Flags, adult religious education, adult healthcare ministry. They're just on and on, and it is so unnecessary to use the pestle and mortar type of dispersal process of taking thousands of church going Catholics and forcibly dispersing them somewhere else.
Colin, can I just interrupt you for half
a
second? You've got people there with you, do you not?
Yes, I do.
Could I get you to pass the phone to someone? Tell me who you would pass it to, and then we'll come back to you at the end here.
Okay, that'd be great. I'm going to pass the phone to Anna O'Leary. Anna is on the pastoral council. She also is been a founding parishioner. Was the first woman bride to be married here back in 1954. Here she is.
Hello.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, more to the point, how are you doing?
Well, not very good. We're a lot of unhappy people here.
Now, how many people are there, Anna?
Downstairs right now?
Yeah.
Well, there's probably 10 or 12, but I'm sure there's 40 or 50. We're having a noon service at 12, and the church will be full again like it was earlier this morning.
Now, there were people there overnight as well.
Yes, quite a number of people. They brought sleepy
Anna,
day the night. Children, too. Of course, the schools haven't opened yet. So.
I'm wondering, Anna, how long this is going to go on? Are you just going to stay there?
We're going to stay here. The church hasn't locked it. The archdiocese hasn't locked the doors, so we're open, but we cannot have mass.
I should tell our listeners, Anna, that we tried to to get the archdiocese to join us on the program, and they declined to do that. The only quote
they
that I had...
They declined to talk to us, too. Don't feel bad.
I have a quote from the spokesperson for the archdiocese, Reverend Christopher Coyne, who says he wants to avoid a confrontation with you. He thinks that this can be worked out as Christians.
Well, we're going to court, and I don't think that's very Christian-like. And put a note that Christopher Coyne's not related to the Father Ron Coyne that's pastor here.
I wanted to ask you, Anna, though, what you make of finding yourself in a position when you're here on a radio program speaking out against the archdiocese. That's not the way that you would expect yourself to be participating in the Catholic Church.
No way. I was brought up 12 years at parochial school, and I've taught CCD for 20-odd years off and on as the kids grew up. And I never thought I would be in this position.
Anna, who owns the church?
We do. We're going to prove it next Wednesday.
That's going to court, right?
Yes, the reason we're going to court.
You got somebody else there with you, Anna?
Yes, I have. This is Eileen Tobin. Just a moment, please.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Eileen. It's Dick Gordon with The Connection in Boston. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Dick? I can't say I'm fine. I just got through crying, so I guess I'm a lot better than I was 5 minutes ago.
I was reading about the last few days and weeks at the church and finding that some of the stuff is kind of hard to read, that, you know, the organ of the church is already going off to Sacred Heart, that the furniture is going to be picked up by St. Jerome's, that the carpets in the church are going, you know, it's like a yard sale or a moving sale that nobody wants.
Yeah, well, actually, I think it's the Vatican that should have the yard sale. You know, it's not, I agree with you 100% what you're saying. And it's another form of abuse as far as I'm concerned. It's just all the abuse on the children, and now it's following abusing adults and children. That's all you can call it.
Eileen, I want to know what the whole past few months have done to your own faith as a Catholic. I mean, you're still there. That says something.
Yes, well, I came here 4 months ago because I really and truly had not up to that point found a church that I wanted to go to where I had the faith, but I didn't gain anything from the priests. I just felt that I was, quite frankly, you know, I was supposed to go, so I went. Someone recommended I come to this church. I came 4 months ago. I came on a Saturday at 4:30, and I came back on the Sunday morning, and I made an appointment to meet Father Coyne the following morning. I was completely and utterly taken by the feeling of love and compassion, and he was real. He wasn't a higher up. He wasn't a high mucky mucky. He was so real. And he absolutely represents Jesus Christ on earth. If Jesus Christ was here, I swear he would be very much like Father Coyne.
Can I ask you a question, though, Eileen? I mean, Father Coyne was one of the men who signed the letter asking Cardinal Bernard Law to resign back in the midst of the abuse scandal when that was all coming out. He's been very vocal in his support of the group Voice of the Faithful, who have been equally critical of the church. Do you think that he and you are being punished for that?
Well, it's a funny thing that you should say that, because when I had the appointment with him, Dick, I said, do you think you will be punished? And, of course, at that point, nothing had happened, you know, and it was just we both shook our heads. It's very hard to say. To begin with, I thought it was because we had a lot of land, but now I've looked in the land of the other churches, and now I don't think it's the land. I think it's because we have so many people have come, not just from Weymouth, but from all over, from Duxbury, from Scituate, from Plymouth, from all over the place. And the priest is just drawing the people just like he drew me. Father Coyne is just... I have no words to express except that he is absolutely, he knows everybody's name. That's an amazing thing to me. I mean, he doesn't give communion without using people's names. And, you know, you get 500 people in a church and you know, he knows all their names. I do think if I had to be really, when I say honest, if I had to really think, I do think it's some sort of punishment. That's my own point of view, though.
Eileen, thank you. I wonder if I can just ask you to pass the phone back to Colin Riley.
I will do that. Okay. Thank you, Dick.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Hello, Dick.
Hi, Colin. Quick last question to you, and that's about the lawsuit, because this is one thing that distinguishes the tactics that you as the parishioners of St. Albert's have taken from a number of the other parishes. What's going on there?
Well, the lawsuit was filed last Friday. It's a civil lawsuit. Let me just stop for a second. Our canon appeal recourse now is with Rome, and that has to be filed within the next 2 weeks.
Right.
So once that goes off, that would be the end of the church matter. But that's another reason why we asked for an extension to stay open, at least until we had gone through full recourse here.
But are you trying to get the civil court to answer the question, who owns the church?
Well, actually, the law that established corporation sole, which is how the archdiocese is established, established that the archbishop serves as the trustee thereof, of the individual parishes, the distinct and unique parishes of the archdiocese. So we're just asking the courts to affirm that. But as part of that, there is a prior Supreme Judicial Court ruling that is consistent with that. And in addition, there's the filing of the Archdiocese of Portland, Oregon, in their bankruptcy filing on August 3rd, where they pointed out that they do not own the parishes of their archdiocese. The parishes own the property and assets of each individual parish. And they also asserted in that bankruptcy filing that church law, canon law, also holds that individual parishes on their property and assets as well.
Colin, we have to take a short break here.
Sure.
I wanted to just sneak one more in if I can.
Absolutely.
The prayer vigil that you're holding now, is this a gesture, or are you going to stay there until you get the answers that you want?
The prayer vigil is ongoing, and we're going to be here through, I think there will be milestone after milestone. First one is today at noon. Second one will be January 8th at 2 p.m. in Suffolk Superior Court.
Thanks so much for being with us. Good luck to you.
You're welcome, Dick.
Colin Riley is member of St. Albert's Parish Council, speaking to us there live from outside the church in Weymouth, Massachusetts, where the parishioners are saying no to the Archdiocese of Boston, which is trying to take the keys of the church away. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after the break, we're going to be talking about prospects of other parishes in this area. We'd like to hear what's going on in your area. We're also going to look a little harder at an answer for the question, who owns the church? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour we're talking about confrontation's probably not a bad word, though it's not the word that the people who are the parishioners at St. Albert's would have chosen as their way of dealing with the Archdiocese of Boston. But in fact, they are saying, no, you can't have our church. We own the church. We're asking you and people from other parishes whether or not that, in fact, can be the case, that parishioners own the church, and it's not up to the hierarchy to say, oh, you're closed and you're not. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to have you join us. I'd like to introduce Sharon Harrington, who's joined me in the studio. She's been a parishioner at St. Albert's for 25 years now. She's also a lawyer who filed St. Albert's appeal to the Archdiocese. Now, Sharon, that's not the civil one, but the canon appeal.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's the canon appeal. And basically we're saying that a viable church cannot be closed. You can close a non-viable church, but what the bishop has is an obligation to his people, and if and to not the building. The building is not the church. The community is, and he has an obligation to the community. And if we are vibrant, he cannot close it. And there's a lot of canon law support for that, and canon lawyers that support that position. Another thing that the canon law says is that there's the concept of non-reception. And if a community does not receive a law or decree of the bishop, then it is viewed as not accepted in the community. It's not appropriate for the community. And I believe that not only St. Albert's and Weymouth, but I believe that a large portion of the Archdiocese of Boston doesn't receive that vibrant parishes should be closed. We're certainly demonstrating that we do not receive it. We do not agree with it. And also, canon law says that the bishop should try and work out differences with his people, that there is, in canon law, the idea of conciliation, mediation, arbitration. Our pastoral council, which has been leading this fight, has tried to communicate with Bishop Lennon, who was the deciding person originally.
What are you getting back from these people, though?
We've heard no from response. Someone, no response. And then the thing that really hurts, I think what it is they're very fearful. They have other motives for doing this, and
money?
They really want to.
Is that the other motive?
Motive. Well, money's one. I believe that there is a agenda here that progressive churches are being disproportionately closed. That VOTF affiliated churches are
voice
being,
of the faithful.
Yes,
that you're mentioning,
are being disproportionately closed. I believe that. I don't know how much Archbishop O'Malley is familiar with Boston, but I know that when he came in, all of the people that were making decisions and working with Cardinal Law remained. And when Cardinal Law was asked to leave by the signers of the letter and also by VOTF and a large portion of the people, I believe that those people had a definite agenda and they're making decisions. When our pastoral council asked to meet with Bishop Lennon, they were not responded to. And Archbishop O'Malley has never come to speak with us. And that's part of what bishops are supposed to do. They're supposed to be with their people. I know when I...
Can I just stop you for half a sec? I do want to bring Janine Driscoll into the conversation. Janine is a member of another parish, St. Anselm's in Sudbury. Home is in Framingham. Janine's here in the studio with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to the story of St. Albert's, but yours is an equally dramatic story in St. Anselm's. You're just perhaps a couple of weeks away, right?
Actually, we have a lot of faith in St. Albert's of Weymouth. I've been attending meetings on Wednesdays with Sharon and a bunch of other folks from various parishes to try and stop the closure of these vibrant communities.
Well, okay, what's the news of your church? You got your notice?
We received our decree last Wednesday. And
the decree says you're being closed. Is that what it says?
Period, the end. In spite of the fact that we wrote numerous letters to Archbishop O'Malley, I faxed every letter to the 47 members of the Presbyteral Council. No response, the same as everyone else. We just want to be able to have a dialogue. We don't want to be contentious, but they've forced us to that point.
Janine, what are the legal options that St. Anselm's is looking at
here? We're filing our appeal, canonical appeal. There isn't as much agreement towards going the legal route in our church because the lawyers that are crafting our appeal feel very hesitant towards breaching that separation of church and state. So they're writing a very strong appeal, and we're hoping for the best, but there really hasn't been an appeal that's been... You're appealing to the same entity that made the decision in the first place, so...
But everybody's watching St. Albert's on this one, right, to see how that
definitely
that comes
and St. Susanna's is also very, very strong in moving forward, and they intend to stay in their church.
How do you guys answer the question, who owns the church, though? I mean, is that a simple question? Is there a simple answer to that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The people own the church. The parish owns the church. They are the legitimate body. They made the contributions. The only way a bishop can take the parish is by suppressing it, closing it, and then he gets to take the assets. But as long as the parish is alive, the parish owns their assets.
We're completely self-supporting. We've built our church. Just last year, we put in new classrooms, a new kitchen, and this is
oh my God,
just
with your own
being
money.
Stolen from us. Yes, with our own money. entirely self-supporting. And last year, we took into our community, our caring, committed Catholic community, the Deaf Community Center, which our pastor has served for 34 years, and Catholic Charities no longer could afford to pay the rent for their housing at Bethany.
Where will these people go, the deaf people?
They have not been assigned yet. If you can believe that there is 2 weeks' time until our closing date, and our pastor does not know where he's going. He made arrangements for his own housing because they will not answer the question where he's going to go, and he figures there's every possibility he'll be out on the street. Our deaf have not been assigned.
Let me bring Tom Groom in on this conversation. Tom Groom's a professor of theology at Boston College and author of a book called What Makes Us Catholic. He's been with us on the program before on difficult issues like this one, and he's back again. Hi, Thomas.
Hello, Dake. How are you?
I'm well. Who owns the church? Is there a simple answer to that?
Well, I mean, the theological answer has to be that the people own the church. Now, the canonical answer hasn't caught up with the theological answer, in a sense. If I may take a moment, I mean, the early church, the early Christian communities were very clear about the identity of the church, the identity of the Christian community, that the people of God, the body of Christ, the temple of the Holy Spirit, all of the metaphors and images used for the first Christian communities were all communal ones, and they had a very clear sense of themselves as that the people are the church. Then over our history, as those first Christian communities came out into the Roman Empire, shall we say, the church itself took on a format, a social, political, and juridical format, very much akin to the public structures, for example, the empire, which that's not to fault the church. It was the nearest social structure available to it, and so it began to look much more like a hierarchically ordered community like the empire. And in that time, much of our current canon law was written, or at least the roots of it are there. And indeed, it sounds as if the bishop owns the church, as it were, by way of the church properties. But then the Second Vatican Council called Catholic Christians back to a much more communal understanding of the church. And in a sense, it wasn't a new theology. It was an old theology retrieved that by baptism, the people are the church. And that.
But this isn't the first instance when we can look at the hierarchy of the church bridling at Vatican II, not wanting necessarily to accept what was agreed on, 50 years ago now?
Well, at least over 40 years ago, at least. The points that Sharon Harrington made, I think, are very valid. If a community is a vibrant Christian community, is the church, the bishop, entitled to close it? Even if canonically the bishop is so entitled, and that is debatable, as Sharon points out, it seems terribly both unwise and unnecessary to close a vital Christian community. There are other options, and there are other possibilities. And one of the reasons being given regularly is the shortage of priests. But even short of more creative solutions like ordaining married people and so on, there are lots of parishes throughout the Midwest of this country, and even more so throughout Latin and South America, that function on a lay presence or with a non-ordained person or with a deacon or a vowed religious sister as the resident pastor, and then a priest comes through regularly for the celebration of the sacraments. There are other models and alternatives that other parts of the church are using, so that it is somewhat bewildering that the Archdiocese of Boston insists on forging ahead with such a radical reconfiguration and closing of parishes. I'm sure of the 65 or 70 parishes, I'm sure there are 15 or 20 of them that indeed need to be closed, and that the population shifts and they've served their useful function and they've been a blessing for a season and they need to be closed. But it seems that the majority, 45, 50 of these parishes are in fact vibrant and well-sustained Christian communities. So it seems unwise and unnecessary to be forging ahead. And especially at this particular time, I was struck by the woman who said earlier, Eileen, I think it was from Weymouth, that this is another form of abuse.
We heard a little bit earlier in the program, Thomas, about a court decision from Portland, Oregon. Is this one that we need to pay attention to in trying to get an answer to that who owns the church question?
Well, from the point of view of the law of the land, I think that plea in Portland is going to be significant because, in a sense, the Diocese of Portland is saying the opposite to what the Archdiocese of Boston is saying. And so somebody will have to rule. It'll be interesting to see how the courts respond to this because they can't say one thing in one part of the country and then the opposite in another part of the country.
I want to stop you, if I can, for half a sec. We've got a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Jessica's joining us from there. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
What's your perspective on this?
Well, I think that the gentleman who's just speaking has a really good point when discussing the body of Christ. You know, here in like the area of Iowa, we have a lot of parishes who, you know, get clustered or joined because of the shortage of priests. And there's no real diplomatic way of taking care of that. You know, how do you say to a parish, I'm sorry, you know, you aren't worth anything? That's not the point of the diocese.
Does it mean, Jessica, that as you listen to the story of St. Anselm's and St. Albert's, that you're going, you know, it's tough, but sometimes it just has to happen?
Right, and I think that at some point we need to look beyond the building structure, like this is the building or this is the parish or this is my diocese. As Catholics, we believe very strongly in the Eucharist, and that Eucharist is what binds us not only to Jesus, mm-hmm. but also to all other Catholics, not just in my town, not just in my diocese or my state, but the universal church, that everyone in the world through Eucharist is bound together.
Okay, so let me, if I can, turn that to Janine and Sharon here in the studio. If the church is the people, why are we so concerned with the bricks and mortar? Because the people can go anywhere. The community will exist without that.
Well, I can answer for St. Albert's. We have survivors that haven't been able to go back into a Catholic church except for St. Albie's. We had one person come in for the first time in I don't know how many years.
Survivors of abuse.
Survivors of priestly sexual abuse on children.
Okay.
We also have widows. The widow of the usher that welcomed me into St. Albert's 25 years ago and who made me feel at home. Her husband died last week. She's been very active in our church. At the time when she most needs her community, her priest, her community that know her, that she trusts, and she knows, we're not going to be there for her. We have widows and widowers that have lost their spouses. They're going through a second death. My friend Mary.
But connect this with the place, excuse me, with the church itself. Why is it that building matters in these interrelationships? Why couldn't those relationships and those connections, you know, be moved to a public meeting hall or?
They may have to be. But I tell you what, St. Albert's is there. It's where we've always met. We have a community that is together, and we have a community of people that are doing wonderful things, that know each other, and we're entitled to be there. What the canon law says is the salvation of souls is the supreme law of the church. We have people that have been away for 35, 15 years, and they're coming back. What St. Albert's provides is an open environment that other churches in our area do not, where conservatives and progressives can meet together and work together.
It's not the building, it's the community.
Tom, can you hang on half a sec? Once from Janine and then to you, Tom.
It's the community. We call ourselves a caring, Catholic, committed community. And we have the same situation with survivors. We were the first to reach out and welcome the survivors of Joe Birmingham, who could not find a place to speak or be welcomed anywhere.
You need to explain why it is then that it would be difficult for you or those people to worship in another Catholic church 5 miles away, if that's what the Archdiocese is saying you should be doing.
They're not worshiping there, that we've just welcomed them to meetings and so forth to try and support them. And they actually spoke to the Archbishop to try and help us save St. Anselm's.
You're afraid they'd leave the church rather than go somewhere else. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they're not currently going to the church.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
You know.
But the only place that they're going to be brought in is St. Anselm's.
That they feel welcome is at St. Anselm's because of our affiliate voice that we have there.
Tom Groom, you wanted to get in here.
Well, just Dick, I mean, one of the things to remember is that Catholicism has nurtured, actively encouraged, an extraordinary identification by people with their local parish. The Catholic Church literally divided the surface of the earth into regional parishes, and you belong to your home. In fact, we even use the phrase your home parish. And if you went to the neighboring parish to get married or buried or baptized or anything else, you'd be sent back to your home parish. So Catholicism, even more so than some of our Christian, our other Protestant brothers and sisters, have I encouraged this kind of powerful identification with your local parish as your faith community and the one you hang in with, whether you like the pastor or not, whether you agree with everything and everybody around you, it is your home parish. And we have nurtured that over the centuries. It's been a powerful aspect of Catholicism. So now, when the church takes on to close so many so quickly, it's bound to produce extraordinarily difficult, painful, psychological and spiritual problems for people.
And this, Sharon, is where I always come back on this particular controversy. If there was ever an archdiocese in some state of crisis, if there were ever people, a group of people wondering where they fit and you know, looking for some kind of guidance, you'd think it would be the Archdiocese of Boston. And yet, having just made it through, or still making it through, the abuse scandal, there are all these reasons for you and people like Janine in other parishes to go, we're not getting any leadership here.
Yeah, and we're not. What our Father Ron says is that you can, you have to examine why aren't people coming to church? Why aren't people becoming priests? And he works by attraction. And a lot of the other parishes, you're going through rote motions. When people come to St. Albert's, they run because they can't wait to get to Mass, because they feel welcomed there and they feel a home there. A lot of the other churches may be a lot more conservative. People mm-hmm. drive, like, for example, I've been driving to St. Albert's, which is half an hour away, for 25 years because I felt it was a very friendly, welcoming place, long before Father Ron. But the people there would attract you.
That's a good point. Wherever you are encouraged or directed or suggested to go is not necessarily where Father Ron is going to be preaching.
Oh, no, 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 no. We are there because we are a family. And what they're trying to say is that we are fungible, that we're like a tomato that can be moved from one spot to the other. Oh, the tomato doesn't look good there, so we'll move it over there to another church.
Well, the tomatoes
well,
aren't
not
obedient
fungible.
Enough. Maybe no. That's the problem.
Yes, they don't want committed Catholics. They want pray, pay, and obey Catholics.
It's an interesting thing, this whole question of thinking and raising those questions and not getting the answers. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Who does own the church? Because that's the question people are asking in a number of parishes in the Boston area. It's certainly relevant in other parts of the country, even in other churches, in Episcopal churches, where people are leaving the nation church for other reasons. Who owns the church? Who gets to make those decisions? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. At this hour, the parishioners of St. Albert's, the great Catholic Church in Weymouth, Massachusetts, are holding a prayer vigil in the church. The archdiocese has come and taken the keys to the rectory. However, the keys to the church remain with the people who say they own the church. Well, do they? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's our question this hour. Lockport, New York, next, and Dan's on the line. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, are you watching this closely?
Not very closely, but I do follow your show, and I am a member of the Catholic Church, and I just find it interesting that out in Oregon, it seems as though when it benefits the Catholic Church, that the parishioners, if I'm understanding this correctly, that the parishioners own the church out there, but in Boston, you know, they don't.
Sharon's my lawyer here. That's the contradiction that the archdiocese that's, may find themselves facing, right?
Right.
I think it's a perfect example of the, and I don't mean to be disrespectful for the church, but I will be disrespectful to the people who run it when I say that the hypocrisy and the double standards, I mean, it runs rampant, and not in this, but in a lot of aspects of the church, and it's driving the younger generation away.
Are you seeing that in Lockport as well?
Yes, absolutely.
And is it just that people are not encouraged to feel like they are the church?
When we see that it revolves around money, it's money, money, money. And when we see the riches that are at the Vatican and that the Catholic Church has, but they are constantly crying poverty, and I do realize that some churches may have to be closed, demographics change, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, but in a lot of cases, now here the Catholic Church in Boston won't even respond publicly, and that's very typical.
Sharon, I'm sorry, Janine, the lack of communication, I mean, is there a part of you that is thinking, okay, these guys must have a strategy. You know, they're just not responding now because they want to wait and see what everything's like. But sooner or later, we'll get a chance to sit down with Archbishop O'Malley. Sooner or later, we're going to open these lines of communication up again.
No, the communication lines will not be open. We have a parishioner who received a meeting with Bishop Lennon, the only one that did, because she threatened to withdraw her will. In her will, she committed her house to the Archdiocese. And if St. Anselm closes, she threatened to withdraw that. So she received a meeting with Bishop Lennon. Meeting was not very pleasant. And since that time, he committed at that meeting that he would come and speak to us, even though he admitted that the week before he had been to a church and it was just terrible for him, yet we feel so bad. But she's called every day asking him, when will he come? And she has not received an answer.
You know, with all of this, if Archbishop O'Malley, when he first came in, he was touted for being available, talking to the survivors, just staying with them and working out a solution. He was very receptive. They were praising him because he would work with people. Then he comes in here and an archdiocese that he does not know. And the first thing out of the chute is, we're going to close churches. They say they have lay involvement in the decisions, but really the lay involvement is, where do people go? Where do people give money? That's the actions speak much more louder than words. And a lot of the places where people go and people give money are being closed.
It was totally a flawed process and predetermined to the nth degree. I mean, it was mentally, emotionally, and spiritually grueling what they put us through. I was on the cluster with two parishes. That's all that was in our cluster. And the other church has the vicar in their parish. So, I mean, we're closing.
1-800-423-8255 to Belmont, Massachusetts. Now Christine's with us. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
What are you thinking?
Well, I wanted to say more power to those that are trying to keep their vibrant churches open.
Thank you.
I was raised Catholic. I have two children, young children, who are baptized in the Catholic Church, you know, married, baptized, confirmed myself. I have a close relative who was a victim of clergy sexual abuse, and it astounds me that in Boston, which has such a credibility problem and is driving away people in droves, that they would say to people who actually care to do something, to say, hey, you know, we're going to close your church. You know, of my generation, and I'm 35, people have left in droves, largely because of a perception of arrogance. And a perception that the church does, you know, collects money and tells you to sit down and be quiet. And it astounds me in Boston that you wouldn't even get a response.
Christine, a question to you, though. If this case goes to court, if a civil court decides that St. Albert's and others belong to the parishioners, I mean, that's going to shake the archdiocese significantly. But what about the 35-year-old Catholics who aren't there? Is that going to be the sort of decision that might make people think twice about or think about coming back to church?
I think that people, you know, and I don't want to speak for everyone. I can only speak for myself.
That's fine.
And those that I know. But I think that, you know, people go to church when they feel that there's a priest who is connected, who has
even
a little understanding of current issues. And really it is the quality of the parish community and the quality of the priest at the church that makes someone go to church. I think that, you know, many Catholics my age have a somewhat, you know, our attitudes towards Rome are conflicted.
And, you're being very civil.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, and we could have a whole discussion on, you know, clergy sexual abuse one day and coming out against, you know, gay marriage the next and the moral authority.
Christine, let me, if I can, turn to Tom Groom on this, just on the whole point of what it is, how important it ought to be to church leaders to at least keep these avenues of dialogue open. That's a part that I don't quite understand.
Well, it's imperative, Dake, and I mean the whole theology of the church, and especially the one revived and renewed by the Second Vatican Council, calls for this kind of participation and that we function as a community rather than simply as a top-down type of institution. A couple of points, if I could come back to. In fairness to Archbishop O'Malley, and I want to make this point that yes, he is indeed closing and selling off parishes, but we have to grant that the first piece of property he sold was his own residence. So he he is willing to walk the walk and not simply talk the talk in this regard. However, if I could go back to the issue of who owns the church, there's a very strong tradition within canon law that the intention of the donor is always what determines what happens to the property. In other words, if somebody gives money to the church for a particular purpose, then it has to be maintained for that purpose. And if I could add a little fuel to the fire for Sheeran Harrington and the other lawyers handling this, Canon 1267, Part 3, states that the offerings given by the faithful for a definite purpose can be applied only for that same purpose. In other words, you could make the argument, even from Catholic canon law, never mind from civil law, that the people who have contributed to St. Albert the Great and St. Anselm's and these other parishes who are resisting, the people who contributed to build those parishes and plants and schools and so on, gave for that specific purpose, and that the church even cannot change the destiny of those donations and gifts without the consent of the people who gave them. Now, the donor...
So the people in St. Albert's who gave $3,000 a head for a stained glass window, they are being told by the church that, in fact, they cannot reclaim those windows, and you're saying that the church is on kind of shaky ground with that one.
Even by its own law and by its own tradition, what the old code called the intentione donantis, the intention of the donor, must always be honored. You can't simply ride roughshod over that.
Speaking of riding roughshod, it's interesting that Wilson Rogers, the original lawyer group that was representing the Archdiocese and all the survivor cases before the new lawyer came in, says that once a donation is completed, that the church owns it and the donor's intention doesn't count. We have an individual that donated $60,000 for the exclusive use of St. Albert's Church, and with that we bought an organ. Supposedly that organ is disappearing, but it was for the exclusive use of St. Albert's. We have a $9,000 or $11,000 baptismal font that was for the exclusive use of St. Albert's, and that's supposedly disappearing.
Okay, quick last question, Tom Groom. I know you have to go, but are we going to see this settled legally, ecclesiastically? Are we going to see this settled morally? How do you decide who owns the church?
Well, I think St. Albert's and parishes like it that are offering some resistance are in fact doing the church itself a service. They may not be appreciated immediately for this, but I think taking the stand that they're taking will at least bring it to a head, both canonically and civilly, and hopefully the rulings that emerge will be undergirded by good theology as well. In other words, a contemporary understanding of who makes up the church and the rites of baptism and so on. But at least I think they're doing the whole church a service by forcing this issue into the public forum, by taking a stand, and by insisting that there be some kind of a both canonical and civil ruling about who owns the church.
Tom, thanks so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Thomas Groom is a professor of theology at Boston College. We're going back to the phones to Cary, North Carolina. Dermot's with us. Hi, Dermot.
Hey, how you doing, Dick?
Fine.
I'd like to just make a point that the bishop does own the land in his diocese, and not only does he own the land, but the people of the diocese have to be subjective to the bishop. So if the bishop states that...
Why are you saying that, Dermot? Are you saying that that's your interpretation of the law? Or...
No, that is the law.
Yeah.
That is how Christ set up his church, was to we have to be subjective, like the early Christians were subjective to the apostles.
Well, this I think, Sharon, set aside your law text for a minute, because you're going to leave me behind with all that.
Okay.
But this is the substance of the argument.
Yeah,
that...
but Christ didn't write the canon law. The bishops did. Guess why they wrote the canon law the way they did. But actually, canon law says that the property of a particular entity, the juridic person, which is the parish, the property belongs to the juridic person that legitimately obtained it. In our case, St. Albert's legitimately obtained its own property, at real and personal. According to canon law, we own the church. The bishop, or the archbishop in our case, only gets to take over our real or personal property once he suppresses our church. If he were to merge our church, then the property, real and personal, would go to the merged church. The two churches would keep the property. So he only gets it if he suppresses us. And then once he suppresses us, then he can try and get our property.
Okay, but to both of you, because none of us are experts in canon law, or listening are not experts in canon law. Morally, is this an argument? Who owns the church? Or morally, is it case closed that it belongs to the parishioners? Janine?
It's case closed, belongs to the parishioners, but that's not what's happening. It's being stolen by the archdiocese.
No, it doesn't belong to the parishioners. As parishioners, we have to be subject to the authority of the bishops. We can't, if the bishop makes a ruling, we can't come up against that.
You can't even challenge that, Dermot?
Well, no, you can challenge it, but the bishop has the final word, and it has to be that way.
No, he doesn't, actually.
Yes, it does. And
why does it have to be that way, Dermot? I need you to be real quick on this one.
Sure. The church is set up so that the magisterium is guided by the Holy Spirit. It's not just some guys in a room making up a bunch of laws. We have to understand that the Catholic Church is led and has always been led by the Holy Spirit. So for us to say, you know, these guys coming up with these laws, oh, no, they're wrong, and they're just going off by themselves.
Okay, Dermot, I want to let Sharon in here.
Dermot, after the bishop makes a decision, by canon law, we are entitled to go to the congregation of the clergy to see if his decision was correct, and then we're entitled to go to the apostolic signatura, and those bodies get to decide whether or not the bishop was correct. So the bishop is not the deciding person in these decisions. They're actually the body of the Catholic Church permits several other layers to review his decision.
This is the very essence of this church, though, is it not?
Morally, is this what Jesus would do?
What? Answer your question.
This is not what Jesus would do. There is no pastoral care in this process at all.
Amen.
I think we'll come back to this subject as it unfolds, particularly in this area, but as we look at the way the decision in St. Albert's and St. Anselm's and other parishes will affect, in many ways, the future of the Catholic Church, because these are decisions that aren't just in reference to one particular parish. I want to thank both of you for coming in. Sharon, it was nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for having us.
Sharon Harrington is a longtime St. Albert's parishioner and lawyer who filed St. Albert's appeal to the Archdiocese. Janine Driscoll, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Janine is a member of St. Anselm's in Sudbury. And Thomas Groom was with us. He's a professor of theology at Boston College. Earlier in the program, we talked with Colin Riley, Eileen Tobin, and Anna O'Leary, also members of St. Albert's. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.